This show is sponsored by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great tasting, healthy snacks right to your door. Forget the vending machine and start snacking smarter with healthy and delicious treats like dark cocoa almonds. Support this podcast by ordering a free NatureBox sampler box at naturebox.com/Joey. That's right, free NatureBox snacks are found at naturebox.com/Joey. They send you four small bags, one big one. It's great to have at the house. It's better than eating potato chips. Really, they're really good. naturebox.com/Joey. Go to meetundies.com/Joey and check out the pics of all the men's and women's underwear they have. For girls, they have hot-looking boy shorts. Go to meetundies.com/Joey or go to joeydiaz.net and click on the MeUndies banner and get 20% off of your first order. And right now, they're giving you free shipping if you live in the United States and Canada. Go to onnit.com and use code word CHURCH to get 10% off of any of their great supplements. Alpha Brain, New Mood, TrimTech Immune, TrimTech Sport. They have the Stay On It program. It's code word CHURCH to get 10% off. And go to irondragontv.com and use code word JOEY to get two free rentals of all of the great martial arts movies. Iron Dragon TV is a brand new Roku channel. It has all of your favorite martial arts movies. They have a great series with On It now. They're showing a lot of On It videos on there. So it's code word JOEY to get two free rentals. And go to Nanotech's booth 15423 at CES tomorrow at 2 p.m. Sorry.
It's the first fucking Tuesday of the year. Here you are, sitting there like a fucking mutt. Oh shit. Spark that motherfucking bong. Uncle Joey's coming for lunch, bitches. Ch, ch, ch. What? Oh shit. The Church of What's Happening Now coming at you. The Flying Jew in the house. What? Oh shit. Oh shit. If you ever get a chance, see The Doors live from the Hollywood Bowl. Watch this motherfucker tear this up!
It's a little more mellow than your intro.
Listen to that. Listen to that fucking bass. He's working it. With a little girl in a Hollywood bungalow. Are you fucking kidding me?
Are you a lucky little lady in the city of light?
Oh, there's another lost angel city. What? Are you fucking kidding me? Turn that shit off. Fucking tremendous. Church of What's Happening Now, special edition on a Tuesday afternoon. Maz Jobrani's in the motherfucking house. The Flying Jew's in the motherfucking house. And my fucking main man, Damon Zwick, is in the fucking house here. What's up, brother?
Joey D, how you doing, baby?
All fired up. To me, honest to God, like, yeah. I'm a big Leonard Skinner guy and I'm a big Led Zeppelin guy. One of the best written songs is that song.
Yeah.
It's got everything. Listen to the beginning. The first 2 minutes takes you through a fucking... Then he sues you down. Then he finger fucks you. And then he just blows up in your face. Then he got arrested for jerking off to that Mr. Mojo Rising. He'd have his dick out and he'd be fucking banging on...
How long is that song? That song is...
Tremendous. That's one almost of the greatest. 8 minutes.
That's what's crazy is they used to do long songs.
They didn't give a fuck.
Yeah, they don't do that
anymore. If you could cover the spread, you could do whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
That is a covered spread. I see your hair is burning. Hills are filled with fire. If they said I never loved you, you know I was a liar. Yeah. Are you fucking... And he wrote that here on a hill, getting his dick sucked, eating acid. There's none better. There's none fucking better, man. You know, what are you going to do, Lisa? This is the kind of shit you eat edibles and you go home and you go, what the fuck was I thinking? I thought I was funny.
No, but they used to. That's the thing is that the world we live in now, they don't do, you can't do a long song like that. Does anybody do that? I guess the techno
they
DJs.
They have a hard time fucking walking these fucking morons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Never mind a long fucking song. These guys are musicians, man. Yeah. Do me a favor. If you ever, every Monday, go on VH1 and see on Friday night, the Friday night concert. And if they ever have the Doors live from fucking just tape and watch it and just watch what he was doing at that point. What he was doing was fucking phenomenal. phenomenal. My Jabroni in the
Joey mother. Diaz, how you doing?
How you doing, baby? What's Joey happening, bro?
Nothing, man. Good to see you, baby.
Good to see you. I'm so happy you came on. You
You're know, one of the guys you. We check in from time to time. We stay in touch.
Always.
It's so nice,
always,
man.
Always been like that. You're one of my all-time fucking favorites.
Right you back were there at for you, me. Man.
Never fucking judged. You were just a soldier and shit.
That's right. Science.
What's going on in your life and shit? What's Nothing, this movie man. Monday night?
Movie Monday night. I made a
That's
movie.
That's the one you wanted me to do that Friday, and
yeah,
I was leaving
yeah.
town.
Yeah,
I
yeah,
you
yeah, yeah.
Me. Thank
yeah.
you for thinking of me.
No, of course, man. No, I did a movie. It's called Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero, which is based like a Persian Pink Panther. Like it's like this Persian dude. It's this Iranian dude who's obsessed with being an American hero because he was a big fan of Steve McQueen's back in Iran. And he finally wins the green card lottery to come to America. And he wants to come to America and be a cop like McQueen was in Bullet. He wants to just be a cool dude. And he shows up, but the best job he can get living in Westwood is working as a security guard at a grocery store. And then somehow he stumbles his way into this plot to start World War III. There's like a Dick Cheney type who's looking to start World War III so he can sell drones. Because he's an arms manufacturer. So he tries to set this guy up as a terror suspect so that he can prove to America that Iran is out to get America, and then he can start a war with Iran. But now Jimmy Vestwood has to save the day somehow. And he stumbles his way through it, and he saves the day. And it's a comedy. It's like a Pink Panther-type comedy. And after seeing it and thinking about it, I've realized that it's a movie that's for like 13 to 15-year-old boys and stoners. I think they're going to love this movie.
So if you fart and giggle, this is the movie for you.
Fart and giggle. There's farting in the movie. I'm serious. It's a fun movie. It's silly. It's not one of the, you know, it's a movie where you got to go and you can't like go there with like a critical like mind to go like what, you know, oh, he, you know, whatever, like, oh, what's the statement? You know what I'm saying? It's like you can't overthink it. That's what I'm trying to say. You got to just go there and say I'm going to have fun with this movie. And I enjoy it. I think we did a good job. I co-wrote it, I star in it, I produced it, I co-produced it, and I tried to get all my friends in it. And it's tough. Making a movie is tough, man. We raised the money. I have such a respect now for filmmakers because a filmmaker. See, as comedians, we get on stage, we do 15 to 20 minutes. It go well, it go poorly. If it goes poorly, you move on, you go to the next club, you do another set that night, life goes on. You tweak it right there on stage. If you're having a bad set, middle of the show, you go, what's wrong with you people? And you start going at them, you have a good time, you move on. Movie is very different. You spend years writing it. You spend years raising the money, convincing some dude that he should put his money into your project, getting the money together, getting it done. We did a 3-week, 18-day shoot, 6 days a week. I mean, it was intense. Then you go into the editing and you go, oh, wow, this movie's different than what I thought it was going to be. Like I heard somebody said that Ron Howard said, you make a movie three times, one time on the page, one time on set, one time in editing. So we're done with editing, and like the movie was at like an hour and 25, and we did a screening at an hour and 25, and like what we thought was funny, all these funny little scenes put together for an hour and 25 started to drag, and I was like, oh no, we're done. But then we went back and we edited some more, and we brought it down to like an hour and 17. We lost 8 minutes, and now it moves. Right. Then we put music, and it moves even more. And I was like, oh, we got something. Now it's you got this thing, and it's like having a baby. You go, I got this baby, and it's a cute baby. But now you got to get a distributor that'll come on board with you to go, yeah, let's get this out there. Because what distributors go, they go, well, is Tom Cruise in this? You go, no. Is Will Ferrell? No. Is so-and-so? No. How am I supposed to market this? Well, I'll tell you what you got to do is you got to think outside the box. This is me talking to the distributor. You got to think outside the box and realize I got a fan base, and we can do something like they did with Borat. And get this out and just leak it to little like younger kids and get some billboards out in the specific cities where I have a fan base, and we could target these people and get this into limited release and let it build. But now I got to convince distributors that that's the strategy that they should take. Otherwise, I got to distribute it myself.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you thought about doing an interview style?
What do you mean? Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah. Well, that,
doing
yeah.
it online?
Well, that's the idea. The idea is that could be the next way to go. The problem is someone's got a call. The problem is that, you know, again, even to do it interview style, I could put it out there and go, here it is, guys, $5 a pop, do it. But I could probably get like, I don't know, 10, 20, maybe 30,000 people might do it. But if I can get someone to have some money in advertising, I read about some of these movies that they make, some of these like romantic comedies that you know is just going to be stupid. And they'll make it for like $12 million and they'll spend $20 million on advertising. So you go, oh shit, 20 million on advertising. So I need someone to put a little bit of money into it. So it just goes beyond just my Twitter, Facebook, and whatever, Instagram. You know what I'm saying?
But the cool thing is like you could put it out online and then maybe our distributor will like it. And then those people who already paid for it online, if they love it and they love you, they'll go and see it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main thing is my hope is that some distributor will come on board and go, listen, we'll sink some money into some billboards and just some things, just whatever, just some advertising. And we'll do an LA, New York, San Francisco release. Let's see what happens. You know what I'm saying? If I could get that, I think we'd be in good shape. But regardless of what it is, the good news is we made it for a little amount of money compared to what they make movies for. And I think it's got potential, man. And you know, it's the hustle. I keep telling people in this business, in life, no one's going to hand you anything. You got to create your own opportunities. You know, and that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to do that. And it was great. I was able to call up friends and say, come on the set and be a part of this movie. And that's half the battle. It's just getting your friends into a film so you can have fun and have the history when you make the film. So that's that, man. That's what I got going.
Let me ask you something. I've never known this. It's how does an investor make money on a movie? You come to me and you go, I want to make this movie, Joey, for $7 million. Can you give me two? And I go, I like the script that much. You got a couple people in there. You tell me about your little Iranian fan base and some white people. You got in New York. Because I know a ton of white people. I go watch it.
Yeah.
And it's not all about the fucking Iranians. Leave them alone. They're working hard, those people.
Working hard.
And I give you the $7 million. Where's my money coming
from? First of all, it's a gamble, right? So if you're someone who's got $7 million to give towards a movie, you're probably someone who's made a lot of money.
Right, I got $50
million. You got money elsewhere, and you could probably make that money elsewhere better than you could do it in a movie. I mean, the movie is like it's a long shot in many ways. Unless if I say to you, listen, I have Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise, I got Angelina Jolie, we all lined up ready to go. And then you go, okay, great. No matter what happens, even if it's shit, someone's going to buy this and watch it, and there'll be some money coming in. But ultimately, you know, like what we did was we did an Indiegogo campaign, like a Kickstarter, and we raised some of the money there. That was basically the base money. And that's just people giving you money to go for it. They're like, I support you. Let's do this. After that, I had a few people come on board who were like, listen, I got money elsewhere. I want to support you. I want to try this. I want to get into this world and check it out. Now, it's a long shot. The chances are, so if I make that money for that movie, let's say it is a, just to make it round numbers, let's say it's $1 million movie. If I make that money for that movie for $1 million, a producer one time told me, once you start making 2.5 times the investment, that's when you start getting profit.
Well, they're hoping for like a Paranormal Activity sort of thing where it costs $1 million and you make $100 million.
Exactly. Or even listen, if you make it for $1 million and make $10 million, you've made money. Everyone's made money because I don't know what the exact math is, but I guess like a couple million in, now you're starting to make some money off of that. Because what happens is when you invest, the first money that comes in goes back to you. The money goes back to you plus a percentage. So usually what you'll say is, you're going to give me $1 million? I got to give you, on the money that we make, I got to give you $1 million back plus 15%. Once that's been given back, then we go back and we start paying the people. And I learned all this as I went through it. Then we got to pay people who got deferred payments on the film. So, for example, you got a movie star to be in there, and they said, I'm going to take a little money now, and I'll take the rest of it once money starts coming in. Well, I got to pay that guy. I got to pay the deferred payments. Once those have been paid, now we start splitting the money. Half the pool goes to the investor. The other half goes to the creative team. From there on, all the profits. So ultimately, it's you're taking a gamble on it, right? But you got to sit there and look at it and go, all right, you know, I think this has potential. Let's do it. And a lot of investors, you know, a lot of big money guys put money in and they get burned once or twice. They go, I'm done. I don't want to do this shit anymore. I'd rather just go and make my money off my real estate where I know what I'm doing.
Like the people who get Spider-Man 2 and, you know, those type of movies, they've been doing it for 30 fucking years. They're in.
Well, that's a studio. So that's that. That's
a studio.
That's
film.
A studio, and that's where this what we just talked about comes in. So those guys go, they spend $100 million on the film, another $200 million on advertising. So you can't avoid it. You go to McDonald's, it's on a cup. You're driving down the street, it's on 4 billboards on every corner of La Cienega and Venice.
So after the movie, then you have, I know that there's a movie on HBO right now, or Showtime. It's Ray Liotta.
The Iceman.
No. Is it on?
Yeah, Iceman was on HBO with Ray Liotta.
Yeah,
was
I saw he? That. I saw that.
But what was the one that he's on with Justin Timberlake's wife, where she plays a stripper and he plays her father? We've discussed this movie, True Blue, Powder Blue. Armando Casillo's the hot dog man.
Right.
Powder Blue has the black...
Powder Blue.
Who's in the movie? Read the thought. Listen to this lineup.
Yeah.
This is a,
oh, yeah, there's a lot of people in it. Hold on.
This is a $100-a-day movie.
Jessica Biel, Forest Whitaker, Ray Liotta, Lisa Kudrow, wow. Patrick Swayze, Chris Christopherson, and that's pretty much where it ends.
Wow. This is a $100-a-day movie that they shot on Gardner and Sunset. They switched. They went from the toy store to the Thai place, and then they crossed the street. It's amazing. They shot it all in that area.
Oh, wow.
At night, the whole thing. And I talked to Armando Casillo. I saw him in it. Armando, how'd you get that movie? Because it was a $100-a-day movie. I go, how didn't that movie hit? Patrick Swayze plays the strip club owner with a wig. He's getting his dick sucked by Japanese chicks and shit. And Beale plays the stripper. Tremendous. And Ray Liotta plays her father who comes out of jail. He
right.
doesn't tell her he's the father. He's getting lap dances. All fucking creepy. And the other guy plays a fucked up black dude that wants somebody to shoot him.
Okay.
That's what the... I mean, it's a fucking crazy movie. So you ask yourself, how come this movie didn't get released? So I asked Armando, what happened with this movie? He goes, they ran out of advertising money.
Yeah.
They had no advertising money.
Yeah.
And you sit there and go, how do I know about this movie? That's what happens.
Yeah.
That was it. $100-a-day movie. Got the Showtime. They probably made a little money.
Yeah.
Whatever the licensing. I don't know how it works.
They released it in Kazakhstan and Russia in the theaters, and then everywhere else was DVDs.
I'm telling you, man, listen, that's the thing, is you need the advertising money. And that's the battle, is trying to convince somebody who doesn't know who you are, that doesn't know that there's a potential for this. And how many times have you seen the billboards all over town? You go see the movie, it's shit.
Most of the time.
But you went and saw it because they really did. They swung at the fences that first weekend.
Grudge Match. How much advertising they put into that movie? Nobody went to see it.
Well, that happens too. But then you got to look at who are you opening against. What kind of reviews were coming in? You know, reviews could bury you if they. A lot of times they don't even like my philosophy on this whole interview. I haven't seen the interview. I want to see it. But everybody, from what I've heard, it was not that good of a movie. It
wasn't.
So my thought is, when Sony saw The Out, they were like, "Well, shit, this is a good way to get out and stop spending any more money. They've already spent a lot of money on it, and let's do it this way. This is a smart way." They created a buzz and they made a few million.
I wasn't gonna see it, but then when you thought North Korea was behind it, but then it just probably. Basically turned out to be a huge marketing scam, but
yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that could be released online, and it's kind of cool because it shows studios that for some stuff they could. I don't know how big your budget was, and it's a little bit shorter than most theatrical release, a little bit, not that much.
Yeah.
But for $5 online, who Listen, wouldn't spend
well,
that
no,
money?
But here's the thing: so something like that got so much press, like you
right.
just said, they did a limited release in a couple cities. They said they had all the shows were sold out. People were watching it online. It was over the holidays. People were home anyway.
Yeah.
$5, I'll watch it. Why not, right? So they created this buzz that then made people go and say, I'm curious. And somebody, I had this discussion when I was trying to sell my last special, and I brought up the Louis C.K. model. I said, listen, he shot his special, put it on his website, said $5 a pop, and within a week, he sold like 200,000 or some crazy units,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he sold $1 million.
Yeah, but the distributors I was in the meeting with, they said, well, you know, that worked for Louis, but a lot of guys came on board and tried to do the same thing. And I don't know what kind of numbers the other guys got, but they were saying like some of these guys got like 20,000 sold or 15,000. That's a decent number for a comedian. That's fantastic, but you're not necessarily making your money back. So that becomes the issue with putting it online. Is you have to be able to still spend some money on advertising or somehow come up with something, ultimately it's a smart advertising campaign where people beyond your loyal fan base of whatever that is, 10,000 people that are really loyal, that'll buy whatever you do, you got to get it so that other people go, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because you could point at the interview and go, wow, they made a few million in a few days. Well, that's because they were all over the news. You know, the North Korea was talking about them, right? So, of course, you're going to see it. So, I got to find a way to get North Korea to talk. I mean, I was joking when that was going on, because the movie talks, you know, has political stuff in there. I was joking. I was like, we should have killed the one, you know, a leader of Iran in the movie just to get the press, you know. But we didn't do, you know, it's not that, you know. So that's the difficulty. It's like having this baby. You go, hey, this kid is cute, and people going like, well, he's not the kind of cute we're looking for.
Well, every comedian is different. Louis C.K. didn't need the internet. What I'm saying, he didn't need the internet support with his popularity.
Yeah.
But there's other comedians that maybe you don't know about that are just internet savvy.
Yeah.
You know, myself, HBO isn't kicking my door down to shoot a special. Neither is Comedy Central. So in my mind, to shoot a special, I'm going to have to do it out of pocket and do it on my own. I'm going to look at my Twitter. I'm going to say I got 150,000 people following me on Twitter. Let's pretend if 20,000 of those people are real. So that's 30,000 people. At $5, what did that come out to?
$150.
My special shouldn't cost over $40,000.
Right.
It shouldn't. Right. Unless those scumbags are going to shoot it from Burbank and tell you it costs $200,000. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they're also charging, you know. So everybody's different. I know 10 comics right now that are mediocre in numbers, but they have a great internet presence.
Absolutely.
And these guys, there's money there. If it costs you $50,000, you net fucking $100,000. And you could still sell your special on Netflix and get another $60,000 on top of that.
Yeah.
That's money, guys. Yeah. That's real. Right?
Listen, you know, I ran into this with the funding for the movie. So what we did was we got Indiegogo to come on board or whatever. We went to Indiegogo to do the thing. And I posted it. And we said, okay, let's go. We said, let's set our goal at $250,000. Just to see if we can get that. Because what happens is they take a certain percentage, and once you reach your goal, they take a higher percentage. So I said, well, let's just make our goal really high. So no matter what, they only get 5% along the way. Even because Indiegogo is different than Kickstarter. Kickstarter, you got to hit your number or you don't get any of the money. So if you say my goal is 50, you better hit 50. If you hit 49,000, you don't get any of it. But Indiegogo has something called flex funding, which is you go on and you go, my goal is $1 million. And you make $5, you keep the $5 because it's flex funding. All right? So that's what we did. We said, let's do flex funding at $250,000. Now, at the time, I had on Facebook like 130,000 followers or something. So exactly like you said, I said, listen, if even like half those people put in a dollar, we're at 65,000 out the gate, right? We put it up. We go, let's do this. And like within a week or two, we'd made like $7,000, just crickets. Nobody's responding. I keep posting, nothing. Now, contrary to when I post something and I go, hey, here's a free video, I might get like 1,000 likes or just a lot of people on board. I would post this thing, give me $5 for this thing, and I get like 10 likes or something. And I was like, what's going on? Well, I went into the numbers and I looked at it. First of all, I realized that I had like 40,000 followers in Egypt or something. And those are probably not even real. I don't even know. But jokingly, I was like, well, I can't make a movie, but I could probably start a revolution. Like if I said, meet me at Tahrir Square, it's going down. But secondly, I realized that a lot of people now are used to getting free entertainment. All of us, you get this clip, you watch it, right? Some people still get the concept that we are artists creating stuff. And they go, I want to support you. I'll give the $1, give the $5. I think that's what Louis did that was smart was, his website, he put it out there. He said, listen, guys, this is a movie I just made. My special I made for whatever, $200,000. It's going to cost you $5. I know you could probably pirate this and get away with it, but I would hope that you would support me and the people that made it and blah, blah, blah. And people came on board. They were like, you know what? He made a good argument for this. And then once he made that million, he came out and put another email out and said, guys, this is what I'm going to do with the money. I'm going to give $100,000 bonus to the people that worked on it. I'm going to put $100,000 towards my kids' college funds. I'm going to give $100,000 to charity, and I'm going to put the rest. But he actually kept – so people were involved, and they were on board. So you got to have a fan base that's also supportive and understands that. So there's that as well. So for me, I know that there's a lot of people in my fan base that do support, but I also know there's a lot of people in my fan base, hey, it's just the natural thought process from my culture, Middle Eastern people. They're like – give me one. What's wrong with the bootleg? You know, it's all right. I'm supporting you. I'll come see you live. But you know what? I've seen you live several times. I bought a bunch of tickets, so I'm going to take this one for free. That mentality is there. So that's another thing you got to fight. You understand? So I understand what you're saying when you look at your Twitter followers and you go, hey, if I put it out there, they probably will give the $5. And hopefully they're supportive and understanding of your art enough to do that. But I have a fear that some people are not going to be, some people just want your free jokes. They want the free jokes. They want the free podcast. They want the, they want all the free stuff, especially younger people that, you know, unless if you, again, like you make a good argument, go, listen, let's do this together. Let's get out there and do it. So
that's there's a lot of people who will pirate it. There's a lot of people who will do that. But I think there's also a lot of people who might pay $10 for it, yeah, or might buy it two or three times. So I think it, I don't know if it evens out, but it gets close to it, I think.
Well, absolutely. Listen, man, there's been guys, I've sold merchandise at my shows before, and there's always the guy who comes up and goes, give me 10 of these. I want 10. I'm going to give it out to my friends. And I go, this guy gets it. This guy's a baller. He knows what's up. He's supporting me, and he's helping me, you know. But there's also the guys who will come up and be like, hey, man, come on, man. You threw out some free T-shirts. You didn't give me one. Come on, man.
I got one of those the other day. I was like, someone's like, can you hook me up with a shirt? I was like, I used his line. I said, not really.
Yeah.
Like, you can't really. Yeah. Hook you up with a shirt?
So it's, but that's why I think it's you got to go beyond, and it is kind of like what you were saying, like being internet savvy. If you're able to get people to help you get the word out, because you got to think. So if I have a guy who's a real hardcore fan, if he understands that he should take that clip or that movie and share it with five of his friends and go, yo, hey guys, get on board. It's kind of like having foot soldiers. You know what I'm saying? It's like in any town, when you go to a town to do a show, if you can find the social butterfly in every little group and go, listen, I'm coming out, bring 10 of your friends, have them buy tickets, I'll give you 2 free tickets, have your friends buy some tickets, come on out, have a good time. You need those foot soldiers to go out and hustle for you to get this sold, because we don't have the money that some of these, you know, studios have to go, because that's what happens. The studios put it all over the place, and then kids are in the car with their parents. They go, we got to go see Spider-Man. And the parents go, okay, we'll go see Spider-Man. We got nothing else to do. So we don't have the money to do that. So we got to go grassroots. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of the battle I'm in. One part of it is creating your own product. The next part comes in selling your own product. You know what I'm saying? Like I wrote a book too that's coming out in February. And I got to get the word out about that. And I got people going like, well, I don't read. And I'm like, well, buy the thing and give it out as a gift. Use it as a coaster. I'm trying to come up with funny commercials, funny posts to put on Facebook where I'm like lip syncing the different songs, because I'm selling tickets to shows. And if you buy a ticket to the show, you get the book, right? So it's like now I got the merchandise. Now it's getting people to buy it.
The amazing education that we've learned as comics is I never really knew Roseanne coming up or anything. But there was a conversation she had that made me feel like a fucking savage. She had a conversation with, who's the guy on TV late night that, not Letterman or one of those guys, the other guy, Rose, Charlie Rose.
She
was talking to Charlie Rose, and she said, they asked her about ABC. You saw that?
I've talked to you about it.
Brilliant, yeah. Brilliant. They said to her, you know, when you did your ABC party, what did you, why did you throw the executives out of the Christmas party? Like, she went fucking, and why did you fire everybody, and why did you put your own writers, you know, at the Comedy Store? She took certain writers for certain things. And she said, listen, what you motherfuckers don't get is there's all these people involved, but as comedians, we do everything. We direct, we write, we produce, we do everything, you know. Now, with social media, they've added marketing, which either you suck or you don't. I always sucked at it because I was always embarrassed. But eventually you have to go on social media, and that's added. That's a different talent, you know. Anybody could Twitter, but they say no, they don't want to tweet the 140 characters. We have friends that are horrible Twitters, and we have friends that can't fucking write, that can't spell, that, you know. Twitter to me is a gift.
Yeah.
Because I work on my stand-up. I work on one line. Something crazy happens, I'll type it out, and then there's words. Oh, it's 180 words now. Within 10 minutes, you'll have it down to fucking 140. And
I was talking to Dane Cook, who's very good with social media, and he made a good point to me. He goes, listen, man, he said something like, I don't know what his percentage was, but he was saying, like, he's like, 75% of the stuff I post, I try to make it entertaining. Then another, like, you know, 5% is just serious, you know, whatever, you know, stick to your dreams, blah, blah. And then the other 20% or whatever, what did I just say, 75, 20, we know what I'm saying. The last percentage of it, he said, is announcements of, I'm going to be here, I'm going to be there. Because if all you do is, I'm going to be here, I'm going to be there, eventually they're lost. That's just direct marketing.
Get free 5 tickets for my shows. Yeah. I ain't going to do nothing. You got to talk with them. I love the relationship I have with people on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
There's people I have conversations with for a year, and then they come to a show, and we meet, and we're friends. I love it. I love what it's become. Yeah. 2 years ago, I fucking hated it.
Yeah.
I thought it was retarded, people following you. What am I, a swami?
Yeah.
I'm going to have people fucking follow. I don't know if I... And then you start thinking about what it's really about.
Yeah.
It's this friendship that you have with this fucking computer, this energy. And I see it in the mornings. I have people come up to me in the show and go, oh, man, the other day, you played Achilles Last Stand. It knocked me off my fucking chair. Really? A fucking song?
Yeah.
That you could access yourself on YouTube? You know, little fucking things. So I've learned. It's been... It's been tremendous. It's been, then, you know, I never expected to even be good on a fucking computer.
Yeah.
And I love it. I have no, you have to market as a comic. And we've met comedians for years that used to pack rooms, and they were horrifically bad. And you go, how does that guy pack rooms? He's a marketing specialist.
Yeah.
There's people who get banners and go out to malls and shit. I can't go to a mall and give you a fucking flyer.
Yeah. No, it's part of... Listen, man, it's part... I always say that we have to be very entrepreneurial. Like, I got my... Like, at any given time, I've got, like... I'm pitching a TV show. I'm working on a movie. I'm writing a book. I'm trying to get an app going. I'm tweeting. You got to be... We have to be entrepreneurial because ultimately we are our own product. And everything that comes out, you look at Woody Allen. When Woody Allen started making movies, he took all of his jokes and started putting them into his movies. When I made my movie, I took some of the jokes and I put them in my movie. When I pitched my TV show 2 years ago, I pitched a TV show to CBS and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to pitch. And I was like, wait a minute. I've been working on this the whole time on stage. I go, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the story about the Russian basketball coach with my son in the room. That'll get him laughing. I'll talk about my Guatemalan nanny. And I'll talk about my two kids won't let me sleep. And I just went in and pissed. And they were like, we love it. But I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't have to sit there from the start and go, what is it? I go, I know what it is. It's this material. Right? So we're constantly writing. We're constantly being. And that's a beautiful thing. I tell a lot of people from a lot of different aspects. You know, people think, how do I make it? How do I? I go, don't worry about that. Just create your own opportunities. Just keep finding ways to create your own. And we ultimately, we're in the trenches doing that. And it's a great thing. That's why Roseanne brought those people. That's why when I go out to pitch a show, I'm trying to convince the producers that I'm pitching with to go, listen, I don't want some dude that I don't know who is a showrunner who used to write on Taxi 30 years ago, but he's, because he did that, he continues to run shows. We have a totally different sensibility. You can put me in a room with him and say, give him your ideas. He's going to turn this into a show. I don't need to do that. I got 10 guys at the Comedy Store who I know are good writers, who are my buddies. We got the rhythms down. Let me bring them in. Let's come up with some funny-ass shit, and then let's go to this network, this cable network, because cable network will probably be more likely to do this.
Absolutely.
Here you go. This is what it is. You know, this is what it is. Let us do our own thing. Like the guys did with Workaholics. They did their own thing, and now they're doing it, you know. So you do need to control it. You do need to... Stop, you know, having people push stuff on you, and you need to prove yourself over and over and over again. We proved ourselves with the Axis of Evil comedy tour. Before the Axis of Evil comedy tour, nobody thought there was a market for comedians of a Middle Eastern background. They're like, what is that at all? Right? They didn't get it. There's black comedy. There's Latino comedy. There's regular comedy. There's alternative comedy. Who's gonna come see a bunch of Middle Eastern guys? And we had to go out and start booking our own. We got our own. We eventually got our own theater in D.C. and sold out 1,400 seats. And then we went to San Francisco and sold out 1,000 seats. And then that's when our managers and agents were like, who was the promoter? We go, we were the promoter. They go, how'd that happen? We go, people want to hear this. This is during the Bush administration. There's a lot of lying and bullshit going on. And we're calling them on it. And people, not just Middle Easterners, but white people, liberals were coming out going like, oh, we love this shit. So we go, wow, there's an audience for this. So that finished, and it's continued. Now, for me, I've continued to tour. There's an audience. But like you were saying, try to convince some of these networks that there's an audience for this. Let's try and push one of these. You know, they still are probably, they were nervous to get, you know, Cristela back on. You know, they were nervous to get a Latina on. They're nervous when they get Blackish. Oh, it's a hit. They're like, how's this a hit?
Well, that's because of an audience. Did you not have a Chinese show? Yeah. The Japanese show on ABC.
Yeah.
They went all out. They said, fuck it. We got to get the Japanese market. And you know they got a fucking Indian show cooking. And you know they got a couple of Iranians somewhere arguing in the back room.
But that's the problem. No, but that's the problem is that I think that they feel like there's not going to be an audience. But there is if you do it right, if you get the grassroots going. And you got to keep proving yourself. Because that's where I am with this movie right now, is trying to prove myself again and go, look, there's an audience for this. Let's get this out there. Because ultimately, it's like it's amazing to me because you think everybody knows you until you go somewhere and you do a show and someone comes up and goes, who are you? Why haven't I? You know, you get somebody like some big wig from Sony or something walking up. Where have you been? Where have I been? I've been at the Comedy Store for 15 years.
Where the fuck have you been?
Where have you been? But that's the problem. But here's the problem, though. You also can't blame them because they're in their world, right? We're ultimately a product. We're Coca-Cola. And they haven't seen we're Coca-Cola's knockoff. We're the soda that they haven't seen. They're used to seeing because every time there's a movie being pitched, they're going, okay, so what we're gonna do is we're gonna get Will Ferrell and we're gonna get Ben Stiller and we're gonna get and these guys are great guys, by the way. I'm not dissing them. I'm just saying that's what happens. We're gonna get this guy, and there's a new kid who's friends with Will Ferrell, so we're gonna get him into, and that's it. That's
but
all
you
they
said
see.
The key word. I gotta piss real quick. Keep the conversation. You said the key fucking word, and the key word in this conversation was outside the box. They refuse to think outside the box, and they get the same results over and over. I understand Sony's a corporation, and they're gonna put out 22 projects a year, and 18 of them are gonna be successful, and 4 of them are gonna be horrible, and they expect that. But to take those 4 projects and keep rewriting them with the same fucking people is what baffles me. You know, there's a movie coming out, Dirty Grandpa, with De Niro and Josh Efron, the good-looking kid.
Right.
Zac Efron. Funny, what I read was funny. They have a role in there that if you see it on paper, it's me. It's me. My agent says, pot smoking, older guy, goes to a fucking resort town and stays. You know. Opens up a bodega, whatever the fuck he does. He's into gambling and drugs. You know, not a bad guy. He's not a criminal. He's just one of those guys that's a fucking loser. That's me. No. We got to go with Zach Robinson, Craig Robinson, or the guy from Portlandia. Not for nothing. You know, it's been done. Let's think somebody. They don't. They refuse.
Yeah.
Then they get the same fucking results. And they can't figure out what the fuck is happening. My pet peeve right now. It's comedy clubs that don't know about a podcast. That you get there and they look at you like, so how many people are performing? It's a podcast. So is it singing and dancing? It's a podcast. So is there an opera? It's a fucking podcast. Are you a fucking moron? Do you know what's going on, you fucking moron? It's 2015 and you're putting a list of people. Well, how much stand-up time are they doing? It's a podcast. Well, how many people are going to be going up during the podcast? And how much time? You've been there. You've sat there and have heard it. You don't want to do business with those people. Because this has been going on now for 5 fucking years. And you're a manager of comedy or whatever the fuck you are. You know, there's a story when Maron went to his management and said, I'm starting a podcast. They looked at him and said, what?
Yeah.
And he said, bye. And look what happened today. Look what happened today. How can you as a manager or anything not listen to your client and get, let me go see what he's doing. Let me go see what this, you're onto something. I'm not going to baffle you on the phone. As a client, you're going to go, really? 15 years and you're telling me my idea sucks? Bye. Some other manager picked him up. He's on IFC, my friend. It's not ABC. It's not HBO.
He's doing his thing.
Politically Correct started on Comedy Central, did it not? And then it went to fucking ABC. Nobody remembers that shit, did it?
Yeah.
I got to go pee. I don't know
take
if it's
a piss.
The old days, the thigh. I don't
know
what
the
fuck.
That's all right.
Lee, keep him on ice like Tony Montana.
Have you ever done an edible with Joey or no?
I don't know if I've done an edible
isn't
with
tricked
Joey.
You with it?
Listen, man, I'll tell you. I need to be in like a controlled environment because I could get paranoid with when I get high.
Yeah.
I definitely can't drive high.
He's crazy. Because we do live podcasts at the Ice House and he drives me back because it's way too long. He'll do like 90 blasting music and just beeping at cops.
Oh, wow.
It's terrifying.
It is terrifying, right? I mean, I'll probably get high like, I don't know, 2-3 times a year if a friend of mine has something, you know, because I'll drink, but I've never been, I just don't function that well. And I got friends that function very well. I have friends that I've been in the car with as that friend is driving. they've like taken a hit and they keep driving and they just get high every day and it's no big deal to them and they can function.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good like that. Like I if I get good, like if my friend brings some good friendly pot, then I can hang out and laugh.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I'll start getting paranoid. Like, especially if it's got that little paranoid thing. Like, there's been times where, like, I was at a movie and I thought the chair was moving.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, Joey Diaz doesn't have friendly weed. So, yeah. So you don't really do anything that's to enhance your creativity. It's just you being you.
It's just me, man. I think what I do is I just try to go on stage. Like, first of all, one thing I learned early on was don't get drunk on stage, because if you do well drunk, you're going to think that's what I need. That's going to be my crutch.
You get superstitious?
No, it's superstitious. You start going, oh, wow, I'm looser when I'm drunk, and this is how I'm going to work, right? So now every time I go on stage, I got to get drunk.
Right.
Right? So two things. First of all, the one time I went on stage I was drunk, was I'd been at dinner and like had some wine. And it was like a Wednesday night or a Tuesday night at the Comedy Store. So it was kind of like going in to do my 15-minute spot. And I went up there, and I was just kind of loose and saying stuff. But it was funny because the audience wasn't laughing, but my friends were laughing in the back because they're like, look, he's fucked up, you know? So that's when I realized, well, first of all, my mind wasn't working as fast as I wanted it to be.
Right.
And I wasn't doing what I necessarily wanted to. I was having fun, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't necessarily, I wasn't being as like where I needed to be with my head. I'm talking about like how I learned early on not to get drunk on stage, because even if you have like, let's say you have two beers and you go up and you're like, oh, wow, I'm loose, this is great, and you kill it. Well, now I think to myself, the next time I go on stage, I got to have two beers to keep this going. As opposed to, I prefer going on, you know, look, I'll have a glass of wine on stage or a glass of tequila or something. I'll have a bottle of water with me up there. 9 times out of 10, it's like I'm having some water and stuff as I go. And I just need to remind myself that I'm funny and creative without the whatever. Like with the water, I'm just good.
Yeah.
You know, because part of it is letting go. Part of it on stage is letting go. And I think the Comedy Store helped me with that a lot. The original room at the Comedy Store, you were talking about Freddie Soto earlier. I remember early on at the Comedy Store, so I'd come from a series of bringer rooms where it was just 10 horrible comics, me being one of them. But I was always one of the funnier of the bad comics starting out in the bringer rooms, right? And I'd always have like 5 or 6 friends, and I would just do my set. And I would get more laughs than everyone else that was horrible, horrible. And so I left, like once I became a regular at the Comedy Store, I didn't realize that you're not doing a monologue. You got to be present in the room. So I'd go up at the Comedy Store when I first started out, and I would do my monologue. And now I have a room that's not a bringer room, it's customers. And they don't know who you are, and they're just staring at you. And then I remember I saw Vinny Favorito come up, and he used to do, it was material that he would talk to the audience, and it would seem like he was making it up as he was going. But it was material. But it seemed like he was making it up. And the audience felt like they were part of the show. And I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. Like, this guy's not doing a monologue. He's kind of doing material, but he's talking to them. And I remember one of the first times I let it go was, it was a late night, and there was like 2 employees and Freddie Soto sitting in the way back. And I never really met Freddie. I maybe said hi to him once. And I was the 145 spot, so I'm the last spot of the night. And there was these 2 nerdy dudes with this really hot chick at the Comedy Store sitting on the booth to the right. And I went on stage. I started doing my set and just doing my jokes. And about 2 minutes in, I realized they're not into it. I'm not into it. I was like, I turned to those guys. I go, guys, forget my set. I'm just curious. How did you two end up with her? And it became a conversation. And I started making fun of them, like, what's going on here? Like, you know, and then we started having fun. And then I started riffing on stuff. And it was 15 minutes of just letting it all go. And then I came, as I was leaving, Freddie was sitting in the back, and I sat next to him. And he's like, hey, that was good stuff. You just, you know, you went for it. I go, thanks. He goes, you're funny. I go, thanks. He goes, you know what? He goes, it's not about bits. He goes, you're either funny or you're not. If it's about a bit and that's what makes you funny, then forget it. But you're either funny or you're not. And that's when I realized it's about being loose. And look, to this day, we all have situations where you tighten up. You know, if I'm doing like a corporate event, I'm looking out and it's like a bunch of like 70-year-olds. I'm like, this is death. I got to do an hour with these people. Like, I know that, right? And all I'm thinking that whole time is maybe I do think, hey, you know what? I'm gonna have some tequila to relax. You know, but But most of the time, it's about being loose. And I think that's why, like for me, like I said, like I don't take anything else to loosen up creatively. I just go on stage on a Tuesday at the Comedy Store and I go, look, I had a crazy day today, got in an argument with my wife. Let me talk about it a little bit on stage. Let me do some jokes that I know are jokes that are going to work, and then let me get into this bit about my wife.
Well, which is scarier? Because I think I know the answer because I've heard Joey talk about it. If you could do a 145 on a Tuesday at the Comedy Store in front of two people, or a room full of 70-year-olds when you're doing a corporate event.
Oh, I do the 145 is much better than the 70-year-olds. 145 is awesome. 145 on a Tuesday night at the Comedy Store is great because you can, because they know what's up, you know what's up, and whereas the corporate in front of the 70-year-olds is somebody's paying you good money to make them laugh the way. You know what happened? The sound?
No. He was asking me about Freddie Soto. Who was it?
Oh, well, we can get into Freddie as well. But the corporate problem is what happens a lot of times with corporate events is the guy sees you somewhere and loves you, and he's like, I'm bringing him, but he doesn't think about his demographic. You know, this guy himself might be 35 or he might be 70 and have a great sense of humor, but he doesn't think that this is like a whole other thing. And they're all in round tables, and they're, first of all, they'll put a dance floor between you and them, so there's already 30, 40 feet. They may as well be on the other end of the
fucking Jupiter.
Yeah, they're not paying attention.
Have you done them, Joey? I didn't think you would have done any of them.
Yeah.
What were they?
The one I did was so bad, because that's what happened. I was at the New York Comedy Club. You know, I was, honestly, I was 3 years in. I had 8 minutes of material. And they saw me on one of those days.
Yeah.
And they asked me what I wanted. And I said $1,500 without even knowing. I'd never been paid before, guys. I'd never been paid before. And I went and did it. And I get there on a Saturday night. And it's on a pool with no microphone, no nothing. And they're a half a mile away. They're in fucking Jupiter, man. Yeah. And I go up there and I'm starting nothing. Nothing. It just got worse and more. There was no connection. I wasn't really prepared for it. And the guy that brought me was like,
this ain't what it
he
was.
He was trying to clap. And
yeah.
It just wasn't that. It was that magic night. It was, you know, when you first start comedy, you know, you have magic nights. You have one every month, then two every month, then three. Well, this was the magic night. And I died. So I just walked off. And I remember I met him in the laundry room. And I said, I need my money. And the guy wouldn't even look at me. He's like, huh? And he just started giving me money. And he goes, all I got is like $800 in a check. And I go, done. And I just took the money and went to the city. I remember all I cared about was if I could still get coke. I was going into the city to buy one of those death packages because I had bombed so bad. But he does real corporates. See, he does real corporates. And he does colleges where people tell you it's great money. You're going to have a great time. But after a while, you see those guys, and they're like, I can't do another fucking college.
Listen, here's the thing. It's all about the setup. I try to get involved the setup, okay? I did a corporate in Dubai one time for this company that was like, they did some tech stuff. The company itself was out of Saudi Arabia. They had their offices were in Dubai, and their employees were from everywhere, India, you know, British dudes, Australian dudes. The CEO was an Australian. All these different things, right? Now, I've traveled to all these places, and I got a couple of jokes about every place. And I told these guys, they set it up outside, nice hot day in Dubai and at night with big screen, and they had Brazilian dancers and shit. But I told them, I said, listen, whatever you do, you got to have couches up, because they go, we're going to have couches and shit. I go, have them close, everybody close, get them tight. And what I did was, this worked out really well because I have jokes about every country. So I'm like, hey, this group right here, where are you guys from? We're Indian. I'm married to an Indian. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-boom, right? Making fun of them, right? What's your name? Patel, ba-da-ba-da. Oh, Patel, da-da-da. And they're loving it because I'm making fun of their guy. Where's your CEO? Where's he from? First of all, you got to go after the guy.
Yeah.
Go after the guy. Where's your CEO? Where's he? Australia. Aussie, tough guy. And I'm not like an insult comic. I just kind of have fun with it. You know what I'm saying? So what happens is you do a couple of those, then you go into some of your material about you, then you do, and they set it up perfectly, fantastic. After the show, they want to hang out with you. They're like, "This is touchdown, right? This was great. Everyone wants a picture." Then they got the times when they'll be like, this dude, like, I never do, I don't want to do bar mitzvahs, I don't want to do weddings, but this dude was like, listen, man, it's my kid's bar mitzvah, and, you know, we're spending a lot of money, we're doing it at the Waldorf Astoria, they're big fans of yours. Now, the kid is 13, they've seen me do a video on YouTube, we're talking about this earlier, they've seen a video on YouTube that was funny with different voices and stuff, they haven't seen my stand-up, right? I tell him, I go, listen, man, I go, I don't know if it's a good idea, listen, we got this ballroom, it's going to be great. I go, well, what about this dance floor? He's like, I'm gonna get the kids to come up and they're gonna sit the dance. They're gonna fill up the dance floor for you. That'll be your audience, and then the rest of the people. I go, all right. He wants me to do an hour. I go on stage and I realize, first of all, when he said kids, he meant kids. There's like 3 year olds sitting in front of me. All right, so now try and do your jokes about anything, about your wife, about your kids, about your whatever, anything about fart in front of 3 year olds. They're not paying attention. So I got to babysit the 3 year olds. I'm looking out in the audience. Grandma's there. There's 90-year-olds, all right? There's one table in the far back that's my demographic that's laughing. The rest of them, like, know me from videos and shit, right? So I was supposed to do, like, a half an hour. I ended up doing an hour because I was looking for the laugh to get off of. Kept going, going, going. Finally, I was just like, the whole time I'm thinking to myself, I got to finish this and go get a double tequila. I need my, that's what I'm thinking. And it's funny. Here's what's crazy is I was done. As soon as I was done, to them, I'm still a celebrity. So after the show, after I was done, music starts and they're all pulling at me to go dance with them. And I thought, I should have just done an appearance fee. I should have just said, I'll come to your place, I'll dance with you, and we'll move on with our lives. You know, because that's the other thing is if they have the expectation. I did this. I talk about this in the book. I talk about going to Dubai to do, it was an art fest, and they had a night where they were selling like really pricey art. And I go, the kiss of death is when people show up at like a $200, $250 ticket function, and they come up to you before and they go, I love your stuff. I've seen your YouTube. I bought tickets specifically to see you tonight. So I go, now they expect you to kill, right? I go, the best is when they don't know who you are, and afterwards they go, that was great. I had a great time. So that's one of those. I showed up at this art thing, and man, these guys, again, no expense spared. Like, they had, like, these guys were bidding for like $100,000, $200,000 art pieces. So at the very beginning of the show, I'm sitting down. I'm supposed to be the headliner. They start their entertainment at 7. First of all, anyone who does stand-up knows audiences can sit for an hour and a half. That's it.
That's it.
That's it. Or you give them an intermission. I always tell them, I go, listen, Broadway has the best dancers, singers, choreographers, writers in the world. If they go to 2 hours, they take an intermission at an hour. Or they get out at an hour and a half. So you want to do a five-hour show? I go, you out of your fucking mind?
You're fucking out of your mind.
Right? So I show up, and these guys started at 7. Cocktails at 7. Let's go into the hall at 7:30. 7:30, they bring out this dance group doing some crazy Michael Jackson shit you've never seen. The dude had, they put these lampposts in the middle of this ballroom. The guy was levitating. He was going horizontal. That's how fit this dude was. I was sitting there going like, holy shit, I got to follow this? They do like half an hour of that. Then they go, all right, let's take a break. The charity people are going to talk about what the charity is about. They talk about the charity. Then they go, okay, now we're going to bring out people that have benefited from this charity. Lady comes out. My son would be dead if it weren't for you people. Da, 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 da. Now everyone's down. I'm like, fuck, I can't follow this. Then they do a auction. The auctioneer ends up being a funny dude. And I'm watching him. I'm like, they didn't need me. They got this guy. He's killing it. He's raising these guys like $1 million. People are bidding, you know, getting tense between like the two really rich dudes who are like, everyone else has spent 25 grand. These guys are 250 grand for an art piece. But this dude up there, the auctioneer's making it funny. He's looking at one guy. He's like, oh, this British dude. He's like, he just outbid you. Don't let him do that in front of your wife. You got balls or you got balls? What's wrong? And the guy's like, fuck it, 270. I'm like, shit, I'm entertained, but I'm also shitting my pants right now. Then they go, all right, now let's eat dinner. Now we're like 3.5 hours, 4 hours in. People have spent like, I don't know how much, $500,000, right? They've seen amazing entertainment. Now I'm like, when am I going up? And then they go, now for dessert. The chef of like the biggest hotel in Dubai comes out with a team of Filipinos. And each Filipino sets up a station at your table. And the chef is German. And he starts calling out orders to prepare the dessert in front of everybody. All right, now take the sugar. Put the sugar down. Everyone puts the sugar. these Filipinos put sugar. Bring out the chocolate. I'm like, this is fucking crazy. The dessert is entertaining. This is like going on and on and on. And then the fucking DJ goes, all right, now Maz Jobrani. That's it. I'm like, motherfucker, you're supposed to, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to fucking get their attention, focus them back on the stage. We're not, if I were a musician, I could go up and like just play the drums or something. You don't need to pay attention. But you need, I need your focus. This guy didn't give me a good intro. This is midnight now, 5 hours in. People are there thinking I'm a superstar. And I go up and I'm like, this, I gotta bring them back. I gotta start working. I gotta work the crowd back to, I gotta be my own warm up guy. So I start doing some crowd work. And at one point I go, I heard there's a Kuwaiti royalty here tonight. Where is he? Sir, where are you? And I got jokes about Kuwait, how they wouldn't let me into Kuwait because my passport says born in Iran, even though I'm American. It says born in Iran, and Kuwait and Iran have problems. So every time I go through Kuwait, they'll hold me like an extra half an hour to ask me who my dad was and my grandfather. I don't know what they did. But anyway, so I was going to do some jokes with the Kuwaiti royalty. I was going to go after him. Well, it turns out the Kuwaiti royalty was a lady that I'd met earlier that night. Someone introduced me to her, but they didn't say, this is Princess so-and-so. They just were like, hey, Maz, you know her. And I didn't know who she was, but I was like, of course. Of course I knew. So now I'm on stage looking like, because when I go, where's the Kuwaiti royalty? The lady who had introduced me looked at me like, motherfucker, you said you know. And then the Kuwaiti royalty lady thought that I knew who she was. So she's looking at me like, what the hell? Like, you said you know who I am. So then I was like, oh, your highness, good to see you. I didn't have a joke. I'm not going to make fun of her. So good to see you, ma'am. Then I go, okay, let me keep moving. I keep moving. Then I'm looking for, there's an Indian dude The auctioneer had been talking to the Indian dude, and the Indian dude's sitting in the back with like a Nehru jacket, you know, the Nehru that like the buttons up at the top, very gentlemanly looking. He had gray, kind of dark hair, but gray streaks, and the auctioneer kept calling him the Silver Fox because he had the silver, right? He's like, the Silver Fox, you want to get involved? Go ahead, give us a bid. And so now the auctioneer had done his homework. Whoever had organized this thing had told him who is who, so he knew who everybody was. So now I'm going, all right, you know what? The royalty shit didn't work. Let me go to the Indian guy. So I go to the Indian guy because I got an Indian wife. I go, maybe I'll do some of those jokes. I go, what's your name? He yells it from the back. I can't hear it. What's your name again? Can't hear it. Have some fun with it. Move on. Do my thing. Very mediocre set. I have this expensive suit. It's drenched in sweat now because it's been a half an hour struggling. And the whole time, again, I'm thinking, just get off and get a tequila. And I get off. I'm like, fuck. And then I'm talking to the auctioneer afterwards. And he's like, yeah, man, that, you know, the Silver Fox is one of India's most famous actors. So it's as if, first of all, I didn't know who royalty was. I didn't know who the Morgan Freeman of India was. He'd been in the room. You know what I'm saying? And it was one of those things where it was death. And it was one of those things where you go, man, I don't know. Like, I'm sure those people had come to that thing going like, oh, this guy is that guy. And then you let him down because the setup is just a horrible setup. You know what I'm saying? It's very important to have the right setup.
But otherwise, they did the worst thing with you. They did a six-hour show. Listen, as soon as they call you and they're breaking it down, you got to go, ah, the magician, get rid of him. Well, kids love magicians. Well, the thing starts at 8 and the magician's going up at 11. It's not going to work. Well, really? My friend, listen, they're sitting for fucking an hour, but they don't know this.
Yeah.
The other thing, I don't mind doing a corporate where I go up, do 20 minutes, I'll do the homework on the company. They'll point me in the direction to one guy, maybe. When they come to me and go, that guy he fucked a faggot on our last trip. I don't give a fuck. And you always get those morons. He has six toes, you know. He has a webbed foot. You know, go away. Go the fuck away. You know, those idiots. But I did one that was the worst. You talking about that just reminded me, and I almost got into fisticuffs. They saw me at the store.
Yeah.
Cuban family. Christmas party, the whole thing. They were offering like some absurd amount of money, and I go, and I remember I was like on coke then. If it was $100, but I knew. I had done enough of these motherfucking things that you can't let them slide. So the number he offered me, I go, it's not going to work. This is the number. Well, we want you to come and do this. You have to do that. They sent me, in those days, they'd fax. They sent me a 3-page fax to every grandpa that was going to be there. You know, he has a web foot. He, you know, and I'm still, listen, guys, I don't. First off, I'm getting off a plane. I'm going from LAX to see you fucking guys in Pomona. It, you know, my mind's going to be somewhere else if you want a Sunday show. And they shrunk it down to 2 sheets. Then they shrunk it to 1.5 sheets because I couldn't take it. And it was a combination birthday, corporate party.
Ugh.
With, guys, it was fucking nuts. And I get there at 2, and it's supposed to start at 3, and it doesn't start till 4:30.
Of course.
But they want the entertainment there early, and a samba band, and a mambo band. And it's 9 o'clock, and I haven't gone up. And I go up to the guy, and I go, listen, 5 fucking minutes I go up, I'm getting the hell out of here. And this guy looked at me like, you can't talk to me like that. Dog, I've been here since 2. I've been fucking going on a plane since 8. You told me 2 o'clock, you know? And then I get here, it's 4:30. No, I'm going up there now. And I go up, and the sheet and the whole fucking thing, and I get off. And he goes, well, you didn't mention my one Uncle Tico that's missing the foot. And I go, listen, give me my fucking check. And he gave me the check, and it was $500 light. And I go, we're going to take a ride to the ATM. Oh, I had to go gangster on the guy. We're taking a ride to the ATM machine. And he started with his shit. I'm going to tell everybody how you treated me. You know, why? Because I want my fucking money. And I said, that's it. And I get a call from them. I get family ones on Facebook and Twitter, and I got offered a wedding October 24th. No.
Listen,
no.
This is what I tell them. A lot of times they'll call me for weddings.
I'll talk them out of it, yeah.
Yeah, I'll talk them. I go, listen, I go, save your money, because I go, I'm going to be expensive. I go, because I don't normally do these. I'm going to be expensive. Save your money, go have a great trip, and I'm going to be in your city in October. You guys come get the VIP tickets. We'll say hi. We'll hug it out. You'll be in my, it's like a home court advantage. Right? And you should be able to do stand-up anywhere, but you have to always set it up right. It's very different than other, again, music, no disrespect to musicians, but musicians can play, and if they're not listening, like if you're playing like rock or something, and people are talking, that's what they do. Right? But stand-up, and half the time I get involved with the organization of it, exactly what you just said. I go, okay, I'll tell you what, you want to do a five-hour event? Cool. Before you bring the food, I'll do my 20. At like, you know, the first hour of the night, and then you guys could do whatever you want. You know, it's crazy. I had one time in Malaysia, one of the kings of Malaysia was at the show, and the prime minister was supposed to come. And the setup was horrible. People all over the place, nobody paying attention. They had like one of their top singers go up, nobody was paying attention. And I'm thinking to myself, because you also bring the, you know, Joe one time, Joey D one time told me, and I agree with him, it's like the Comedy Store, I think, makes you want to be tough as a comedian. Because a lot of other clubs, you were talking about one time you heard one comic be like, oh, I got to follow that guy? I don't want to follow that guy. And at the Comedy Store, you have to follow everybody. As a matter of fact, one of the times that I died the hardest was following you, because I learned a lesson, which was I followed him, he killed. And I didn't acknowledge his killing right there. Like, I had to go up. I should have gone up for the first 2 minutes and talked about his set in a fun way, because we were all in that room, and transitioned into my set. And I learned that lesson right off the bat. Or if somebody says something really, like, crazy, outlandish. Like, Joey says, like, you know, her pussy looked like a bat with a hangover.
Right?
So you got to acknowledge that when you go on stage. You know what I'm saying? You got to acknowledge that he just said that and have fun with it. Even say it, like, 10 times, right? But I didn't. And I learned that lesson. So you want to be tough. So here I was at this thing in Malaysia thinking, you know what? They didn't listen to their top singer, but they're going to listen to me. I'm going to get them. I'm going to go table by table, and I'm going to find out who's where. And I got 20 minutes. I'm going to get them. And I was supposed to go up after the prime minister had arrived and spoken or something. Well, they come to me. They go, listen, prime minister's running late. You got to go up. I go, all right, I'll go up. And it was funny because I started making fun of their traffic a little bit, because we think traffic's bad here. Some of these countries, I don't know how anyone gets anywhere. It's like they have a thing, they say Malaysia boleh, which means Malaysia can. Malaysia boleh. And I kept saying, I was making fun of them. I was like, well, with this traffic, Malaysia no boleh. You guys can't. Like, you guys are all stuck. And some of them like are a little taking offense at it and stuff. And here's what's funny is, I was in the middle of my set. I've never had this happen. Middle of my set, trying to get them going, making fun of their traffic. And suddenly, in the middle of my set, I hear a voice, and it goes, Maz. And I'm like, where's that coming from? I look over at the podium, the host, Maz, the Prime Minister has arrived. Ladies and gentlemen, if you could please rise for the Prime Minister. Everyone stopped in the middle of my set. And so everyone stands up, and here comes the Prime Minister halfway through my 20 minutes. And it was funny because I thought I got the biggest laugh when he came all the way up, and he was like shaking hands. I just had to stand there, just standing on stage, looking left and right. And he came to the front table, and I go, hello, Mr. Prime Minister, sir, how are you? I go, were you stuck in traffic? And his table laughed. He didn't know what I said. The rest of them just went right back to what they were doing. But I got interrupted by the Prime Minister. Imagine like in the middle of your set, and you got to keep going. And it was another one of those where I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get off and just get my drink and relax. Because I don't care who you are. I don't care who. You're not going to win that battle. You're not going to win that because they're there to talk. The women, look, man, we have our own sense of humor. There's a 70-year-old woman who could care less about you. She's there to show off her jewelry, right? There's some dude who thinks he is the man. And so if you go to him and make fun of him, he's going to take offense at that, you know?
Well, it's so crazy how much an audience matters for movies too, but even for stand-up. Like we went to the store 2 or 3 times last week, and the first time it wasn't that great, and then the last 3 times I saw you, it killed. And it's, you're saying the same jokes and some for some people. Sometimes it's some of the same stuff. And when I've heard you do something 10 times, and this one time it's not working, like, it's crazy how much an audience impacts a show. Because it's really probably just as much as
for me, it's comedian. The audience and the comic. And
yeah.
And the comic, sometimes, every time I go on stage and I don't do well, I never blame it on the audience. I always say, wow, my game wasn't on. I didn't know. I thought that was me shaking. I didn't say that joke the right way. I didn't say that. I didn't say fuck. So I always look at it that way. But this is an education that's constant.
Yeah.
I always laugh when I see pictures of George Clooney and Brad Pitt, and they're giggling, and these fucking momos in the Midwest, like, oh, they must talk on the phone every day. They're such good friends. They don't give a fuck about each other. When people's around, they're all smiling and tapping each other on the back, and ha, ha, ha. One thing about you and I, Maz, I know you from the store. I mean, when did you get to the store?
I think it was probably, I started stand-up, I think, in summer of 98. So I must have been at the store by early 2000 or late 99.
Wow.
Yeah.
And she made you a regular. And that was the beginning of everything then.
I grew exponentially at that club.
At that club.
Because I learned so much watching guys like you or watching. Paul Mooney. Like Eddie Griffin, who we would give shit to because he would go long. He would do 2 hours. But those first 45 minutes were very funny, and it was interesting. What I learned from him was kind of whether it's whatever it is, kind of his stream of consciousness style, which was he would go from bit to bit, but he would mix them up. And I love doing that sometimes when I go, you know what? I don't know what bit I'm going to start with, where I'm going. You know, you told me one time, I love Joe. Joey Diaz has the most quotable stuff. One time I said, I go, Joey, you ever put a set list together? And he's like, yeah, bro, I put it together on the way over. But you know how it is. You get on stage, you got to start calling audibles.
Yeah, you got to call audibles.
I got it. It is true. And I love that. I love calling. Like, that's become the last special I did. I went to Sweden and shot it, and I got a production company to shoot it. And I said, I want you to have a camera on the audience. I go, whenever I go to the audience, go to the audience. And it's what's great about, when I saw it, what I was happy about was when I would go to the audience, sometimes they would say certain things that I wasn't expecting, and you genuinely see my surprise on my face when I'm hearing somebody say something for the first time. And that's a great feeling when you're a comedian on stage, because now I'm curious about you. And it's not about my next joke, but it's about, how did you end up with her, or if you're here and you have a 2-week-old baby, where's your wife? And I don't have a joke yet, but he's going to tell me where she is. And if he says she's at home, I'll say, oh, you know, old school, whatever. I'll make fun of him for like being whatever, like, who's the man now? Or if he says, like, I don't know what the answer is going to be, right? But maybe he says she's here. And I go, well, then who's got the baby? You know, we got a nanny. I go, oh, you're rich. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can riff off of that and have fun. Now throughout the show, you can keep going back to that guy. Oh, rich guy. No, hey, rich guy. You know, after the show, he's buying drinks. Now you got an extra 5 minutes added to your special because some guy had a 2-week-old baby that they left with a nanny. You know, and he's loving it. There's a dude on my special named Eugene, some Swedish dude named Eugene. When he said his name, Eugene, you see me genuinely. I go, is that a common Swedish name? And then he's kind of laughing and having fun. And we just go on. I have co-stars in my special. I just thought of that. It's true. But that's because you are being open to talking to the audience. But regardless, what you were saying too is true. Sometimes you're right, Joey. You blame yourself. But you also, there's sometimes where you go, like, we've seen it. Comics will come back and be like, oh, this audience sucks. And again,
it burns me up. I don't say nothing, but it burns. One thing I always respected about you, especially at the store, was to me, everybody wants the 8 o'clock spot. Everybody wants to go up in front of 80 hot people. Mitzi didn't like it that way. When you signed up at the store, you thought you were going to get 10 o'clock spots. But Mitzi gave you the dungeon spots. And I call them the anything could happen spots, because that's exactly what they were. A fist fight could happen in a controlled area, in a comedy store. And late nights, you know, when Mars would go up, we would just chant in the back, Mars Jobrani, Jobrani Mars, in the middle of his set. And I know there was nights Mars would go, thank God these guys were in the room, because that's 6 minutes. Yeah. We would fucking go crazy, Mars Jobrani. And the audience would sit there and go, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
That's the comedy store, you know.
Yeah.
Lee and I had a great time last week when I went to the comedy store, and the piano player kept playing BT Express for everybody.
Yeah.
And I went up to him, he was playing something different. I go, don't play that, play the BT Express. And I danced, and thank God, because it killed, and it took 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, when I walked off and people were like, that was great, I was like, maybe for you. But I wrote a joke for the last two fucking days that I wanted to try specifically.
Yeah.
And that, you know, so here I killed in reality, you know, whatever the fuck I did. But as I'm driving up over Laurel Canyon, I'm like, I'm a fucking loser for not trying that joke that I've been working on for two fucking days.
But that goes back to what Freddie Soto had said. It's not about the bits, because you can try that bit another time. You took that moment and you
figured and ran with it.
And you ran with it. I had two of my favorite sets last year. I've recorded them. Were sets where I did absolutely no material, because I went on stage at the comedy store and I started to get into it. And as I was getting into it, someone came to sit. So then I was like, what the hell? Where are you? Where were you? What's going on? And then they started talking. And then someone else started talking. And then the next thing I know, this happened. It was kind of funny. There was these couple of guys came in late and they sat to the left of the stage. And the dude sat down and he saw somebody in the front of the stage and he started waving. And the other guy started waving. And then I go, you guys know each other? He goes, yeah. I go, you guys, why don't you sit with each other? Like, you knew you were coming. And he goes, no, I didn't know he was coming. I go, well, then how do you know each other? He goes, we used to play in a cover band together. So now I'm like, what cover band? And it was like Creed or some cover band. I go, well, what happened to the cover band? And they go, well, we split up. And I go, ladies and gentlemen, we heard it here tonight. This, whatever it is, cover band is split up. I go, this is a very sad moment. I just need a moment of silence. I just riffed
for 15,
man, and I love that set. And I didn't care about the material I was trying to work out. And that's a set that, you know, if you're a comedy fan, I realized this later. Somebody was talking about it. The reason I got into this was because I was a comedy nerd. You know, you have to be. I used to watch all those guys. I used to stay up late night, watch all the reruns of Saturday Night Live and the new ones. I used to watch all the guys that were on the Evening of the Improv, all that stuff. So if you're a comedy nerd and you hear a set like that, I think that you have to ultimately sit down and go, I appreciate this. I might not get it all because I'm not in that room, but I appreciate this. When you see Pryor do that set that he put up, I forget what it's called, where he's like in the back of a club and people are walking out and he's like, I hope you get hit by a train or whatever, and it's the worst set you've ever seen Pryor do, but he put it out as a special. You got to sit there and go, I appreciate this. You know?
Stand-up's a weird fucking animal. Before, when I was going to the bathroom and I was walking back, I was thinking about, you did a play one time, and one of the times, what's his name was there, Sean Penn. He came up to you, he gave you a number, he took your number, and like he called you a year later or some shit and put you in a movie.
No, he didn't do like that. I did a movie with him. I did I don't think he saw me from a play.
Oh, I thought he saw you at a play.
No. The movie was The Interpreter.
The Interpreter, okay.
And that one, the way I got that one was funny. Again, I talk about this on the book. Get the book, people. It's called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Played One on TV. It's funny because all these stories come back when you start talking about this stuff. The book, what was funny was, you've done this before. I'm sorry, the movie, The Interpreter. So Sidney Pollack's directing, Sean Penn, Nicole Kidman. It's in New York. And I'm pretty early in my career. It's 2004. And they go, they want you to put yourself on tape. Now, you've done this before. When you put yourself on tape, that means you go into a room, you put a camera, you get a friend to read from the other side, you do it yourself, you submit the tape. And I'm going, there's no way they're going to cast me off a tape. Because if you go in a room, the director's there, he likes you, but off a tape, you go, no way.
I fucking hate him.
I hate it.
I got the longest yard that way.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing was the scenes they gave me to do. So I was playing, I was auditioning for an Arab American Secret Service agent. His name was Muhammad, but they don't even reference it at all.
Go figure.
But they don't reference it at all. They just call him Mo throughout. And at one point he goes, I'm from Brooklyn. He goes, he's in New York, right? And so he's very Americanized. And I think the reason the writers might have put him in was because right around that time, this was around the Bush administration, there had been a Secret Service agent who was an Arab dude who was flying from, I don't know, L.A. to Phoenix to go be on the Bush's detail. He was going to go protect the president. And Secret Service agents carry guns, and they have a license for it. So he was getting on the plane, and the pilot was like, I'm not going to let you get on my plane. And he goes, but I'm a Secret Service. I'm legit. It's all been approved. It's like, I'm not letting you on my – it was like a Delta or something. And he ended up suing Delta and made – I think he won or something. But point is, I think the writers had read about that and were like, let's put some dude in here as that role. So I went to read the audition, and the audition was very procedural. It was like two quick scenes. The first scene was, let's say it's me and Joey sitting next to each other, and we're in a car, we're Secret Service agents, and we're following some guy who we think is about to commit a crime. And so he turns to me, he's like, is that the guy? And I go, that's the guy. And he's like, well, what do you think we should do? I go, well, let's follow him. Cut. That's it. Scene two. Do you hear about the guy? Yeah, I heard he's downtown now. Well, let's go get him. Let's go. Cut. And I'm like, I didn't do anything. So I submitted. And I go, there's no way in hell I'm going to get this. And then the word comes back. You've had this before, too, where your agents go, you're their number one choice. And that, to me, usually that's the kiss of death. That means they're waiting for
somebody else to say
yes. Yeah, they're waiting for Louis Guzman to take the part. Or they're waiting for, you know what I'm saying? They're waiting for somebody else, Ben Kingsley. Someone's going to come up. So they go, you're the first choice. I'm like, I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to jinx this. Goes on and on and on. Finally, they go, you got it. I go, what? Yeah, you got it. You're going to spend 4 months in New York. They're going to pay for you. They're going to put you up in a hotel. They're going to pay you. I'm like, this is crazy. So the whole time I'm thinking, first of all, I'm excited to be working with Sean Penn. Who cares about Nicole Kidman? Sean Penn, that's the man. I want to work with this guy. And Sidney Pollack. And I get there. I swear to God. So this was a movie. It takes place at the United Nations. And the whole thing is, it's called The Interpreter. And I'm like, all right. Let me go down. They get me out there and they go, listen, they're filming at the UN today. You're not in the scene, but you can go watch if you want. So I go, let me go watch. So I go to watch. I'm watching. Nobody knows who I am. You know, I'm player number 12 or 15 out of whatever, on the call sheet. I'm not one, two, or three. And I'm watching. And then finally I go, all right, I got to go pee. So I go to the bathroom. They're on a break. Sidney Pollack walks into the bathroom. So now I go, should I say hi? Does he know me? Is he going to say, what's up, you're Agent Mo? He kind of looks at me, looks away, goes into the stall. I'm like, all right, there's no way in hell I'm going to be like, Mr. Pollack, by the way, nice to meet you. I go, all right, let's leave it alone. I left it alone. Then the next day I'm shooting my scene, and the whole scene is just supposed to be me in a car doing surveillance with binoculars, and I'm looking into a house. I'm watching this guy who's, again, possible suspect. And what it is every day he has the same thing for breakfast. And they're trying to get across the point that I've been sitting here watching this dude for a week. So I'm supposed to look in the binoculars, talking to myself, and go like, you know, up, orange juice, cereal, milk. Great. Put it down. That's like the line. That's the whole thing. So action. I do it. I'm in a car. There's a little walkie-talkie that gives you direction. Sidney Pollack's voice comes on the walkie-talkie. Do it again. Throw it away a little bit. Throw it away. You're putting too much emphasis. Got it. Action. Cereal, orange juice, milk, whatever. You got to be in the moment. You got to be there. Oh, okay, great. Action. Cereal, orange juice, milk. Seven takes. I'm starting to sweat bullets. I'm like, shit, they cast the wrong guy. I knew it. I thought they'd messed up. I thought they'd messed up the tapes. They were trying to get whatever John Leguizamo, and they ended up getting me. And now he's coming at me, and I was shitting bricks. I was waiting for them to be like, okay, done. Can we talk to you for a second? Listen, here's your plane ticket. Go back. I really was like shitting my and to my surprise, they moved on. And at one point, like the hair and makeup lady was like, oh, I saw you had your Sydney moment. I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, yeah, he's been riding a lot of the actors. I go, what do you mean? Yeah, he's just, you know, really stressed out because his previous movie didn't make a lot of money, and he's producing on this, and the budget's going up, and they started shooting without an ending. All kinds of stuff you start finding out. And supposedly one other guy that was in a scene with Sean Penn was like, he got the Sydney treatment so much that he was like having a breakdown, and Penn had to be like, Sydney, let me talk to him for a second. And he got the actor back in. He's like, listen, buddy, let's just do it, me and you. And he got him through it. And what was amazing was as it went on, like, I gained his respect a little bit just by, like, kind of, you know, talking back to him a little bit. Like, Sydney, you're going to ride me again or whatever it was. Like, you know, just a little bit like that. Because you got to realize what happens when you go on a set, and you know this, they set up this hierarchy. And they go, this guy's the guy. Don't look at him in the eye. Don't talk to him. Don't blah, blah, blah. But listen, man, end of the day, I'm a guy.
You're a fucking
guy. I got
guy.
A mortgage. Yeah. I got kids. I've lived 42 years in this world, right? So you're going to talk shit to me just because you're fucking whatever, Jean-Luc Lussard or whatever your fucking name is? You know what I'm saying? I'll punch you in the face, you know?
I get pissed too.
Yeah, you got you.
I had a Sydney moment.
Well, who was that with?
Sydney Pollard.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. What was that in?
Bronx County.
What happened?
I was terrible.
Yeah.
I didn't fucking know. I knew nothing.
Yeah.
It's 97. I get sent to fucking Santa Monica. We go read for a pilot. A Puerto Rican dude in the bar, recurring role, maybe series regular. I go in there, I read, and I leave. I get the fucking pilot. CBS. This was CBS's answer to NYPD Blue.
And Sidney Pollack's directing.
Sidney Pollack's directing. They paid him $3 million.
Wow.
Show's going. I'm going to be in every episode. At the end, the cops come into the bar and ask me questions. You're not going to shoot. You're going to shoot. You're not going to shoot the pilot. You're going to shoot the pilot. You're not going to shoot the pilot. You're shooting the pilot. You're not going to shoot. This went on for 2 weeks. It's a 3-week pilot shoot. It was a drama. I got a call one night, fucking 1 a.m. You're shooting tomorrow. Up at whatever. Be there at 8 a.m., 6 a.m. I don't know. Do I have lines? They'll give them to you in the morning. It's just 2 lines. Ugh. They're writing them right now as we speak, or we could call them to you tonight. I'm coked up at fucking Gardner, living on Gavin's floor. And, you know, I got to go in there the next day. I don't know nothing about nothing. And it was 2 horrible lines. Nothing. I could do it today with my eyes closed. And he had to come over and, like, ask me, like, what the fuck is going on?
Wow. And you fucking, right, when that happens, you just melt.
Listen, I had just bombed on basketball. I had just done basketball. No, I hadn't. That was the first time I really bombed on a set. Then I bombed on basketball like a year later, 6 months later. And it was, I didn't know what to do. And then I finally got into an acting class. And I got a pilot for NBC, like the 5th and 6th episode. And by that time, I had it down a little bit. But I didn't have it. Not to work with Sidney Lumet. Not at all.
Oh, Lumet. You had Lumet.
No. Sidney Pollack.
Well, Muzz, you did Friday After Next or Next Friday, whichever one it was, when you were still working. Because I listened to Minivan Men.
Yeah.
Minivan Men. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Podcast. And you talked about it. And that's, I mean, how crazy was that doing that movie? Well, that I'm was still not, doing a job.
Well, see, now that was different. Listen, man, this is 99.
You had a job?
Yeah, I had a day job.
That's right.
Yeah, I had a day job at an advertising
That's
agency.
That's right.
I used to come to the Comedy Store, do my sets and at like 1 in the morning That's or 2 in right. the morning, and then go to work the next day at 9. But no, but what this is what it is I think 99% of all of this, whether it's stand-up, acting, anything in life, is the confidence that you have. And the more you do it, the more confident you get. And the more control you have, the more confident you are. And the lower the stakes. That's why that original room is such a great room. Because she sets it up and says, no one's going to be in this audience tonight. I'm going to blind the hell out of you with the lights. It's going to be so dark, you won't know who's there anyway. So just go up there and do your thing. So you go up there and you just do your thing. And so the same thing with the Friday After Next. The director was this guy named Marcus Rayboy, young guy. He'd been doing music videos. I went in and I auditioned for the role of Molly, the donut shop owner. And I just went in and did a character. I just went and did my character. And then they were into it. And they were like, yeah. And then I had ideas. I was like, what about if he wears this? What if he does that? And they're like, yeah. So with that, they wanted me, and suddenly I was like, oh, cool. You know, I felt like they gave me the confidence. Whereas a movie like The Interpreter, that's like 80 million, 90 million drama in New York, Nicole Kidman, Sean Penn, Catherine Keener, all this. Sidney Pollack is stressed out because he's producing it. He's getting into arguments with
nobody's laughing.
Nobody's laughing.
Everybody's silent with the director. You know, oh my God, when he comes in the room, don't say a word. And you're sitting there going, this motherfucker puts his pants on just like me.
Absolutely.
And at the end of the week, when you look at half these fucking directors, what the fuck are they really doing with that fucking camera? Okay, what the fuck are they really doing for them to walk around? You know, you could always tell a director on a set, that's the set I don't want to be on. If I could tell who the director is on the set, if he's got the feather in his hat and the rolled up sleeves and the tattoos, I don't want to work with that guy. I just worked with that jerk off at CBS.
Who's that?
I worked with a guy. I watched the CBS award they gave him. CBS did a show, like, and they didn't air it, like, but they was on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Of this director, I forget what his name is. When I read that he was the director, I remember reading for the role and going, wow, I'm going to get to work with this guy. This guy was the biggest piece of shit I had ever met in my life. You know, he blasted Bruce Springsteen. Well, why is this on? And you know, not just blast, guys. And I asked the ADs, like, why is this on? Oh, he's personal friends with Bruce. Oh, so I should fucking fall off my fucking chair? You know, they're just jerk-offs.
Yeah.
Then you work with a guy like Adam Sandler that knows comedy, and you go up to him in front of fucking four fucking Gentiles that are sitting there out of college, and you're like, hey, listen, I want to shoot that scene with a thong on. And the people from Paramount are like, no, shh. What'd you say, Joey? I want to shoot that scene with a jock, like that dude in Major League, the Cuban dude. Go get this guy a jock. No, the network. Go get him a fucking jock.
Yeah.
That's a comedy director. I felt he gave me confidence. He gave me confidence. Give them the fucking red light. There's nothing when you read for people and they come up to you and nag you. The word is the. Get the fuck over there with the word is the.
Yeah.
Get the fuck over there. I made it sound better without the fucking the. But that's, I don't like that. I don't like pressure on a set. I like when everybody's loose, when you could do your own thing. But that day with that comment I did for CBS, I'm like, this isn't, no wonder the show got canceled.
Listen, in fairness to Pollack, the guy is great, and he actually ended up being nice. But I think...
Yeah, he was a nice guy.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. He was very nice. But I think that...
He was great in The Sopranos.
Yeah, he was.
He was great in...
He's a great actor.
In
Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, shit! Yeah. That's my movie
yeah,
and shit.
Yeah, he brought it on that.
I fucking loved that movie.
Look, that guy's a legend. He's great. But what happens is you get in your head, and also there is a hierarchy in every set. And I think it's up to... And I think, listen, these guys, after a while, they got to get shit done. They can't come hug everybody. You know what I'm saying? But ultimately, I think if you're able to lighten the mood somehow. Like, that's what I learned on my movie, the Jimmy Vessel movie. I was a co-writer. And I had a guy directing named Jonathan Kesselman. He directed something called The Hebrew Hammer.
It's a good movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie, right? So what would happen is we'd do a couple takes, and then we'd get together and be like, hey, let's try that again. Let's mess around with the lines. I had friends on the set. I'd be like, listen, man, do what you want to do, but here's a couple of suggestions. You know, say this, 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 and this, but something in that world. Go. You know, and it was fun. Because I wanted to be fun, you know, and I was confident. I didn't have a studio. I didn't have to go. I learned the difference. What was crazy was we'd raised all the money. We did the thing. If I wanted to change anything, I would do it right there, right? A week later, I got a guest star on a sitcom for CBS, like a four camera. And we would do our scene. And as you know, what you do is when you're doing your scene, you rehearse. And then one of the days, you get the writers and the producers and the network and all the studio. They all come. Now you got 40 people watching you do this scene. And you finish. And then when you leave, they all sit down with the writers and they give them notes. And that's when it hit me. I said, that's why a lot of these sitcoms aren't that funny. Because it is comedy by committee. It's art by committee. All right? When was the last time there was a painter standing in front of a canvas with 40 people behind him going, what do you think? Should we go green or blue? Blue. Right? You're no longer an artist. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I think a lot of those things aren't, a lot of these shows that we see that aren't that funny is because they just water the hell down.
Yeah. I mean, say,
Louis C.K. most people will think are consider him great, but I'm sure there's people who don't like him as a stand-up comedian. But say what you want about that. His show, Louis, he's on FX, which wasn't the biggest station. It was a cable station. But he does everything. He writes, edits, directs.
It's amazing.
He acts in it.
Yeah.
And it's cool when they have that much control. I heard you brought up Christella. Her manager came in, I think, and was saying how, and Joey was saying how they gave her money to like do it, but they weren't going to pick it up.
Yeah.
And instead of taking the money, she shot the first show, and now it was on ABC for a full season.
Yeah, listen, that's what we're talking about, that think outside the box. What's great about her story is that they were going to pass on it, and then they said, let's go shoot it. And they got the set, I believe, of the Tim Allen show, and they shot it. And really, man, it's ultimately, it's a battle all the time. But you have a voice, you have a point of view, and not everyone's going to like it. I mean, I get people hitting me up from time to time going, you suck. You're not funny. And I want to hit him back and go, what the fuck do you do? And who are you? But I let it go because I go, you know what? That's actually a point of you've arrived, I think. I actually used to get a little offended by stuff online until I was watching Letterman one night. And he did this joke. He's like, yeah, they just put in free Wi-Fi at Central Park, which is great because at lunchtime I get to take my laptop down there and read all my hate mail. And it hit me. I go, wow, this guy must get so much crap for what he says. Every night you do a joke that's going to offend somebody. So I go, hey, man, I'll take it. I don't care. If somebody doesn't like, that's a sign that you've got a point of view. If people don't like your shit. You know what I'm saying?
I hope they don't fucking like me. They could all suck my dick.
Yeah.
I really do. I love when I get like an email. Hey, man, who gives a Frenchman's fuck? You know, you were making a good point before. One of the best advice I ever saw, nobody gave to me. I saw Pacino tell Jamie Foxx in that fucking, he goes, you know, remember there were...
Longest Yard?
Yeah, no.
No, not Longest Yard. Any Given Sunday.
Any Given Sunday. Yeah. He goes, you know, this is easy, brother. This is just like when your mama used to call you when you play football. Remember when you played two-hand touch on the street? You told the guy, run down to the corner to the car and make the left, and right there, I hit you. Once you simplify it, everything. I was on stage the other night and I was bombing. And I got myself together. It was like getting punched in the fucking face. You have to regroup and breathe. And I became that character. And I took him to fucking, you have to stop sometimes. And the same thing is with acting. My acting now, after 15 years, I go on the set, I'm as good as the next guy that studied at fucking Eureka College, whatever the fuck. Because I've been doing it now. I go on the set now and I'm not effective, but I save you money.
Yeah.
I'm fucking good on this.
Efficient.
You don't have to work. You don't have to worry about me at all. Just leave me the fuck alone. I don't need an AD outside my trailer telling me makeup. I know how to read the scene. I know when you don't want me in my fucking wardrobe at 8 in the morning if I'm going to strip for. I'm a fat buck. You're going to get gravy on the shirt or a reef is going to burn the fucking button on the shirt or, you know. But it's, when I saw you at the store a couple weeks ago, I watched you on stage, Miles, and it's fucking great that we're still doing what we do.
Absolutely, man.
It's been a fucking journey from those little spots. I used to drive me to the ATM so I could borrow coke money from you and shit. Maz was my brother. And then, you know, now we're here. And all those lessons were learned from that little fucking room on Sunset.
Yeah.
And they weren't learned on a Friday and a Saturday night.
Nope.
When we were there on Wednesday nights at 12:45 talking shit.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I'm happy I got the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm happy that I walked into that. It made me a different comedian.
Yeah.
It made me who I am today as a podcaster, a writer. It all started for me at that store. Like, it lifted me up. My wife was saying today that she would be really nice if D'Agostino got made at the store.
Yeah.
Because you become a different comic. You become you see it from a different, you see the ball field, you see people. You know, 15 years ago, we were all at the store doing the same thing, and now and it was me, you, Sebastian, Brent Ernst, right? Same people, same people. I've been doing the podcast the last fucking 3 months.
But
Bobby Lee,
Triple E.
It's so cool
Triple
how like you guys aren't similar in your type of comedy.
No,
but you all come out of that one place. It's kind
we
of
all came
like
out
you.
Of
you wouldn't think like some places have certain type of musicians or this is a jazz club, but that's you're gonna see every different type of comedy that there
you know,
is.
We're both Marines. He might aim for the heart. And I might aim for the fucking eyeball.
Yeah.
You know, we're both fucking Marines. And I think that Marine mentality of the Comedy Store kept us here. I'm bulletproof, bitch.
Absolutely. Listen, I tell young comics all the time. I got guys that I'm telling all. I go, you got to find a way to get into the Comedy Store, or replicate that for yourself. I go, don't get in front of the hot crowds and hot crowds and hot. Get in a place where you have to let go of your material. Find who you are. You know, it's taken us a long time. They always say, you know, it's a cliche. They go, you got to enjoy the journey. Well, I've enjoyed the journey, and I continue to enjoy the journey, because that's why you got to do it because you love doing it, right? And you got to put yourself in uncomfortable situations. That you have to. Otherwise, you're gonna get comfortable, and you're not gonna grow. And if you're ever doing it, I hear some actors will be, oh, well, that one day when I win that Academy Award, just leave, forget it. Why are you doing it? You're gonna win the Academy Award, feel empty. You don't do it for that. You do it because it's a project that you love. It's a story that's being told that you think is great. It's something that you wrote. It's something that a friend of yours wrote. It's a part that you're gonna be excited about. It's another thing that you go, I can bring something to this. I remember I was listening to Benicio del Toro tell a story about being on some set of some like movie early on in his career, and it was like, it was a romantic comedy or what it was, but he said he was on the set and he was just doing the part, and he was kind of like bored because he was just like the supporting guy, like the guy's friend. And he said he was talking to a friend of his who knew him from before, and he was telling his friend how he didn't like what he was doing, and the friend's like, well, didn't you get into this because you wanted to enjoy it, like you wanted to be creative? And he goes, yeah. He goes, well, then go for it. So he said like the next day on set, he started like giving his character like a lisp or something. And the director's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm bringing something. And the guy's like, get out of here. But flash forward to Usual Suspects, when he's like talking like, yeah, well, yeah, you know. Because I think he told himself, I'm going to start bringing something to these parts, as opposed to just sitting at, you know, just, I don't want to be just, you know, just sitting there, you know, waiting for that line. But that's for him. And for me, stand up. I love doing stand up. I love writing. I love creating. And it's like, if I can come up with ideas and ways to go to the next level, get on stage. I just did the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory this past weekend for the first time in a long time. I had so much fun being on stage, man. And I left, and I have fun hanging out and talking to my the guys I start out with. Joey Diaz.
Are you in town this weekend?
I got Tempe Improv this weekend.
Good for you. Let me give some shout outs and we'll get the fuck
all right,
out
Joey
of
D.
Here. What time is it here? Holy shit, we're on. Jeremy San Giancomo. I love you, cocksucker. Thank you for always giving me love. J.R. Gomez, Benny Perez, Corey Pentland, Joe Knows His Gun, cocksucker. There you have it. Who gives a fuck if you went to that place? Captain Redbeard, Anthony Sacco, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my main man, Danny Rodriguez, always fucking representing. You know what I'm saying? What's up with Lee? How high are you?
I'm super high.
Are you?
Those were crazy.
Are they strong now?
Yeah, they're strong. Well, you gave me two of them at 11:30 in the morning.
I ate two of them.
I know you did, but you've been doing it for longer than I've been alive.
They're very mild. Don't let it go. You look good, Papa.
Thank you, buddy.
What else you got the rest of the day?
I got the gym, and I got another podcast at 5, but I'm probably just going to take a nap right now.
You're not taking no fucking nap.
Oh, my God.
We're going out there. We're going to go do some meth.
Keep it going.
The meth. You add some meth to this fucking reefer high, you'll be beautiful. You'll be thankful.
We smoked hash.
You like that, huh?
Like is a strong word.
You should do. You should eat a piece of this hash. Have you ever eaten hash?
Yes. I'm allergic to
fucking hash. Eat no hash, cocksucker. Maz, what else you got going on? Talk to me.
Joey D, I'm gonna go get my kids, and then I'll do a little spot at the factory tonight with the Damarera show, where you do 10 minutes and then you analyze it. And then that's it. I'm gonna start. I'm trying to promote this book, and I got a book tour around it. I'm doing the Wiltern in February. I'm doing a theater in San Francisco. I'm doing a theater in D.C. I'm running.
What's your website that these people could go?
People can find me on Twitter at Maz Jobrani, MazJobrani. Also, Instagram is at Maz Jobrani, or just go to MazJobrani.com. Find me there.
When is the book getting released?
Book is February 17th. February 17th. Book is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV.
I remember us having conversations how people offered you terrorist jobs and you didn't want to take them. I don't want to be no fucking terrorist. I can always be a fucking terrorist. You know what I'm saying? For real. So why would I want to play a fucking terrorist?
That's where that, you know, I did it because I did a Chuck Norris movie where I played a terrorist. And then after that, I said no more. And that
no
was exactly
more fucking
it.
Terrorism, huh?
No more fucking terrorism, man.
Fuck these fucking people.
Movie website.
What's that?
The movie website.
Oh, the movie website is jimmyvestwood.com. That's the word Westwood. With V's, J-I-M-M-Y, V-E-S-T, V-O-O-D. You can see the trailer on that, too. What's funny is I always describe it as the Persian Pink Panther, and Wikipedia picked that up. So now whenever I go to interviews, people go, so you're known as the Persian Pink Panther. Why is that? And I'm like, no, that's just the way I describe that movie. And I've been trying to get that description off of Wikipedia for like a year now. They won't take it off. Everywhere I go, they call me the Persian Pink Panther.
Well, fuck it. Then you're the Persian Pink Panther.
Crazy is that?
Yourself a little Kato to beat you up when you walk
in
the
fucking house. I know you, man. You're my Kato.
I love that shit. He'd tell him, always attack me, and then he'd come home, and he'd look around the house, no Kato. He'd fucking, oh, he's out. He'd open up the refrigerator, and there's Kato in the fucking refrigerator, choke him. And then they would fight to the death.
And he'd be like, not now, Kato.
Not now. And they'd fight. They'd fight. Also, the phone would ring.
Yeah. Right?
The phone would ring.
Classic.
And he'd go, pa, hold on. Inspector Clouseau's residence. It's for you. And before Clouseau would take the phone, he'd punch him in the fucking head one last time. Bam! They'd take the phone.
That shit was great.
Fucking classic, man. Yeah. I just watched Being There again.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
About a week ago again. Yeah. I fucking couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
He is, you know, people forget that motherfucker. I've never forgotten him as a kid.
Yeah.
All those movies are.
The Party.
The fucking Party. Oh, my God. That's it. Right. The Party.
Forget it. Birdie Num Num.
Oh, my God. Now I'm going to have to get that shit. My wife got me hooked on all that Roku, Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
YouTube. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm in heaven now.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I know how to work all that shit. Let's give some sponsors a shout out here. On it! Be the best that you can be. You know what I'm saying? Why fuck around with these Shay type companies and shit? You want to get your vitamins going? You want to... On it's not even about vitamins. It's about fucking human optimization. Whether it's Alpha Brain... Whether it's the Hemp Force protein, whether it's the fucking Shroom Tech, the New Mood, I got you covered. 10% off on your order. Do me a favor, though, just to be friends here. Go to Onnit.com. See what they got available to you. See what works to you. Like I told you 1,000 times, like a broken record. The Alpha Brain got 100% guarantee. If that sucks, why are you going to make a move to something else? If a titty smell like shit, don't even think about finger banging it because it's going to be a fucking disaster. Go to Onnit.com, pressing the word
church,
and get 10% off your next order. Again, we're talking about them earlier. Iron Dragon TV. It don't get no better than that. Classic martial arts films at your fucking fingertips. It's a Roku channel. From the Ip Man series, they got a Sonny Chiba. They add new titles every fucking day. Whether you're a kung fu fanatic or you want to get into it or you want to throw sidekicks for Jesus, do me a favor. Go to IronDragonTV.com right now. Pressing the code word.
Joey.
Boom! And we know what you're getting? Two free motherfucking movies, bitches. That's right. Go to Iron Dragon TV right now. Cut this shit. It's Tuesday night. What are you going to do? There's no Sons of Anarchy. Mama's on the rag. She's not going to suck your dick. You might as well get two fucking kung fu movies and smoke some dope and do some bong hits for Jesus. You're sitting there with those rotten fucking underwear. It's January 6th, and your balls stink like fucking dick. Your fucking asshole smells like a billy goat, and your underwears are all fucked up. And you're sitting there going, I'm going to sling dick this weekend. You ain't slinging nothing but dirty fucking nutsack. Wrapped around with algae and whatever else is surrounded around your dick and your nutsack. Not only that, you're uncomfortable. Go to MeUndies.com right now, okay? They're the best fucking underwears. I don't have mine on right now. I had a pair on last night, yesterday for jiu-jitsu. Again, your nuts never fall out. With those cotton briefs, your nuts are always popping out. You always got to tuck them back in. They smell funny. No. That shit ends. MeUndies underwears has that material. It pulls the fucking sweat away from your nutsack. So the rest of the day, 12, 14 hours, your nuts are fucking fresh. You could dip them in somebody's mouth, and they're like, voila, this is the flavor I've been looking for. You understand me? If you're a lady, you want to keep that pussy fresh, go to MeUndies.com right now. They're giving away 20% off and free shipping to Canada and the United States. Stop walking around with those skid marks and those fucking urine fucking pussy marks in your underwear. How do you think guys are going to eat your fucking snatch if you got a urine mark in your fucking underwear? Take those things out. Go to MeUndies.com right now. Press in.
Joey.
Boom! Get 20% off your first order and free shipping. Why are we going to stop there? I'm talking about free shipping. I'm talking about a dirty pussy. I'm talking about nutrients. Fuck it. You want healthy snacks? Naturebox.com. But I'm going to tell you what the best thing about Naturebox is. It's free, motherfuckers. They'll send you 5 snack packs. They'll send you those swirl fucking cinnamon corns. They'll send you those cocoa motherfucking almonds. they'll send you that fucking high energy mix they have with the chocolate and the almonds and the oxidants. They ain't fucking around. You understand me? No more potato chips. No more chocolate chip cookies. Look at yourself. Does your ass need another fucking donut? Go look at the mirror. Ask yourself. Look at the size of my stomach. It's hanging over my dick. Do I need another fucking donut? Do I need another fucking fat? No! Go to naturebox.com right now and press in
Joey,
and you get a free fucking sample box with 5 bags of the most delicious, nutritious snacks you've ever had in your motherfucking life. Spicy pistachios, sriracha almonds.
Sriracha, yeah.
Oh, my fucking God, okay? My dick is getting hard as I talk about it. Anyway, on it, Iron Dragon TV, MeUndies.com, and Nature Box. Who's fucking better than you, all right? You know how we do it, Lee.
Oh, I thought that was the black lady from the last office knocking on the door.
But fuck her. She's somewhere fucking jumping up and down. Obama's losing. I don't fucking give a fuck anymore about these fucking people. Maz Gibrani, nobody loves you more than me at the end.
Joey Diaz, I love you. We talk from time to time, and it's great to hear your voice, baby.
I leave a message for you. You're my brother.
I love you, Joey.
I gotta call you and shit like that. We'll be back someday next this week. This is a Tuesday special day. We'll be back. We'll do another podcast one day this week. All right, cocksuckers. Have a great week. It's the first week of the year. You don't want to suck dick this week. You want to wait at least 3 years. Have a happy Cuban Christmas tomorrow, even if you're Iranian. Celebrate the Cuban Christmas.
What do you do at Cuban Christmas?
Tomorrow's when the three fucking wise men show up. And tomorrow you don't give gifts. You got to give everybody a fucking 50 or a 20 or something.
So I should see you tomorrow?
Absolutely, because you're going to give me money.
Wait, no. You're Cuban.
Yeah, but Jews give the Cubans gifts. We don't give them a fucking dick. You're not backing us now in this fucking thing. I love you guys. Have a great day. Stay black, all right?
Joey D.
Maz, Tempe, Arizona this weekend. And where you at the weekend afterward?
Back in L.A., baby.
All right, baby.
And you are at the Improv.
I'm at the Improv fucking Saturday night. January 10th, 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock.
The one on Melrose.
I'm the one on Melrose. I got my man Mick Betancourt with me. January 22nd, I'm in Buffalo, New York. You better fucking dress warm. And the following week, Super Bowl week, I'm at the Columbus Funny Bone. I love you guys. Stay black. Wash your pussy. You don't want no fucking antifungal medication in that.
You know the weed's good when you forget where you're going to be. Let's see. Okay.
God bless.
Okay. Now that the show's over, don't forget to go to naturebox.com and
sound. What are you doing with D?
Huh? Okay, I'm going to turn you off. I'll do that. It's okay. Go to naturebox.com and sign up to get your free sampler box of great tasting healthy snacks. Forget the vending machine and start snacking smarter with delicious treats like barbecue kettle kernels. Go to naturebox.com/Joey. That's naturebox.com/Joey. Hi, Joey. Go to meundies.com/Joey. What? Okay, hold on.
No, the podcast?
Yeah, hold on. Yeah, it was. Okay, I'm still doing the ads. Go to meundies.com/Joey and get 20% off of all the men's and women's underwear they have. And right now they're offering you 20% off and free shipping in Canada and the United States. Go to onnit.com and use code word church to get 10% off of all their great optimization products, Alpha Brain, New Mood, Shroom Tech Immune, Shroom Tech Sport, and go to Iron Dragon TV. Use code word Joey to get 2 free rentals of all their martial arts movies. And if you like Tim Kennedy, go to Nanotech's booth at CES, booth 15423, Wednesday, January 7th at 2 p.m.
Sex, cause me so horny.
Oh, me so horny.
perverted. But you say I'm a dog when I leave you fucked and deserted. I'll play with your heart just like it's a game. I'll be blowing your mind while you're blowing my brain. I'm just like that man they call Georgie Putin Pie. I fuck all the girls and I make them cry. I'm like a dog getting beat, a freak without warning. I have an appetite for sex, cause me so horny. Sex caused me so haunted.